Good evening, welcome everyone. We're going to start, as we always do, with a review of last session. So we started off with dueling baraitot. Remember, a baraita is a tradition that is authoritative, it's legal. And we were trying to figure out if, because the text says the best of your land, can it be, does it have to be the best of your land, or can it be the best of cash instead? And that was a discussion that was actually solved. And we talked about how much money you have to lose in order to qualify for the poor tithe. And that was 200 zuz, which I tried to tell you was roughly $15,000, $20,000 in today's money. Then we dealt with the land evaluation, where this was the gladly pay you Thursday for a hamburger today. And how do you assess the value of your land? Is it in the high time or the low time? So that was a discussion. Then we learned that there is not just one land. There is actually three types of land, and they are called superior, medium, and inferior, or best, average, and worst, which we will see much more tonight. And we also learned that there were three payees, not just the damage party who collects from superior land, but we also had the creditor, or in effect, someone who borrows money. They get paid out of medium quality land. And finally, the divorcing wife gets paid out of inferior quality land. And why is this? And this is because of Tikkun Olam. So I just wanted to go off on a tangent because I think it's an interesting and fun tangent about Tikkun Olam. So first of all, according to the rabbis, everyone should get inferior land as a payment for whatever. And that came about because we had a verse that says, you know, bring out of your house whatever for payment. And the rabbi's human nature assumption was that you bring out your worst stuff, not your best stuff. However, we have a specific Torah verse for damaged, which means that if your cow went and ate your neighbor's field, you have to pay from the best land. That was the only exception. However, because of Tikkun Olam, it was decided that the creditor should, instead of getting inferior land, get medium land. Why? Because the rabbis wanted to encourage people to be lenders, because it's a good thing for the community. And this was a Tikkun Olam thing. And here's where I want to go off on a little bit of a tangent, which is we hear a lot about Tikkun Olam in the last few years. And I even checked on Google Ngram. There's almost no use of the word Tikkun Olam before 1980. So this is a very recent phenomenon. And the way Tikkun Olam is used in the Talmud, that we know, everyone knows it means repair the world. And the way it's used in the Talmud is not used in that sense, which is why Tikkun Olam is a relatively new concept. So in the Talmud, Tikkun Olam is better translated as for the public good. And we have a Mishnah which says, one does not ransom captives for more than market value because of Tikkun Olam, and one does not help captives escape because of Tikkun Olam. Now, what does that mean? It meant that there was a business in the Middle Ages or earlier of kidnapping people for ransom to make money. And there are all kinds of stories about rabbis that get kidnapped and refuse to allow their communities to ransom them because of what they say, Tikkun Olam. Because if they do, then first of all, there were two reasons given in the Talmud, that is a financial burden on the community. And the second is that, so quote, so that robbers will not seize more captives. That is, if you pay ransoms, you encourage people to do more kidnapping. And that's the Talmud's concept of Tikkun Olam for the public good. So that has changed in recent times for various reasons we can talk about later. but I just wanted to throw that in there. All right. So with that, I want to do something a little bit different for tonight. So we've been talking this about damagers and damaged parties and reimbursement and so on. And one of the goals of doing this is I want to show you how Talmud works, kind of open up the hood and see the moving parts underneath. And I think we have a really good example starting, let's say, two sessions ago about land. So one of the ways the Talmud works is, and I think you could put this in the critical thinking bucket. It takes a simple or maybe a not so simple case, and then it stretches it and twists it and adds on it and makes it more and more complicated to get more and more out of it. So I want to take that and show where we got, where we are now, and then we will move ahead tonight with more. But this is kind of a refresher for everyone, and it shows you how the Talmud works. We can step back and look at it. So we start with a very simple premise, and you will all now remember the Mishnah about the damagers. And the premise is very simple, right? If my something damages your something, then I owe you money. I have to pay for it. And that's where we come from. Now, we have agreed that I pay you according to the best of my property, not according to the best of your property. And those who remember, this was the Rabbi Akiva versus Rabbi Ishmael debate. And basically here, Rabbi Akiva wins. And also, we're talking about a case where I don't have cash on hand, or as the Talmud would call it, movable property, meaning either cash or small items I could give you. So I can't pay my debt, and therefore I am forced to sell my field and pay you out of that. And those are the underlying premises. And Steve Nagel, we have some audiovisual aids for that. So this is the very simple, basic concept that we started with. Damager owes money to the damaged. It comes out of his field if he can't pay it. Simple concept. Now we move along. This is complication number one. So complication is I don't just have a piece of land. I have different kinds of land. And as I said earlier, we have three kinds of land that's recognized by the Talmud: superior, medium, and inferior. That's a complication. Now we move into the next complication. So we have a tradition, which means we have a baraita, which we've covered, that there are other types of people who collect on debts. They are the damaged party, which we've been talking about up till now. And in the last session, we learned two new. One was creditors, which we can also say are lenders. So that's the loan of money. And we also had divorcing wives. And divorcing wives are entitled to money for their ketubah. And therefore, now we have three types of land and we have three types of payees, people who get paid. And that, by the way, also came out of a baraita as well. So that's the situation. Now, the last complication from the last session was, what if the payer has only, that's the damager in this case, but now in general, it's the person who has to pay, has only two types of land? How does he pay the three types, potential types of people who collect the debt? And if you remember, I made a chart and I showed you how the rabbis rule. It was complicated, a big grid, but that's where we left off last time. So we're going to start tonight with a further complication, but before I go ahead, does anyone have any questions on where we are up till now?
Well, my question goes to, if I owe you $100, Do you care where I get the $100 from?
The Talmud, I mean, cares, right?
That's where I'm getting hung up. In other words, if I do something and I damage your property,
yeah,
okay, and you say I owe you $100 for the repair,
right?
All right, so fair. I owe you $100. Does it matter if I sell 10 acres of my bad land to get $100 or 1 acre of my good land to get $100?
I will just say it matters to the Talmud. So that's a baraita. That's a tradition we have that says if it's a case of something that you are responsible for that damages my property and you should have been careful, then you have to pay me out of the best of your land.
Yeah, that's because usually they don't get that finicky.
Well, but that's right out of the Torah, right? That's what the verse says. The best of your land or the best of your field.
Yeah. Doesn't you know, that's troubled me too, Steve. I mean, isn't that almost invading your privacy? It's, you know, why... You could say damages, but why do you have to say the nature of the of what you're going to sell in order to pay the damages?
So I don't think we covered a reason for that, but I would say if I'm making a guess here that it is in place to encourage you to be careful with your property because you know it's going to hurt if you cause damage. Look, you have an obligation to keep your cow fenced up. And if you choose not to be careful about it, you pay a price. Because otherwise everything else gets paid from inferior, you know, your lowest quality property.
But if you look at the wife, okay, her husband is divorcing her and he also gets to, you know, I don't know whether he sells it to give her the money or just turns over inferior property to her. But, you know, he's giving her the get and he can give her the lowest settlement kind of property.
Right. But everybody except the damaged party.
Him. He's damaging her. He's divorcing her.
Well, first of all, it's not about divorce. It's about owing money. Right? It's about collecting a debt. And the Torah's rule is everyone who collects a debt gets it out of the lowest quality property. Except then you have a rabbinic law, which is lower than a Torah law, saying we'll make an exception for creditors because we want to encourage that behavior. So the wife is it's not about husband-wife things, it's about collecting debt things.
But she is a creditor, right? Isn't she a creditor? Is that the whole thing? So she's just a different kind of creditor.
Which correct. I guess if I can paraphrase Steve for a minute, we're all kind of looking at this backwards, right? We're looking at it as the wife getting less than. I think the way to reverse it is the wife was the basic standard. That's right. That's your basic level that anybody who was owed received. And the texts here are now adding special cases for the creditor and for the person who's been damaged on top of. So it's not that the wife's getting less, it's that the wife is getting the standard and these other two categories are getting extra.
That was excellently put.
Better than the standard.
Right. Okay. Now, before we still haven't started any text yet. Before we do that, let's talk about contracts. So, how did a person purchase or acquire land in Talmudic times? And the answer is through a document, which is called a shtar, or that's the Aramaic word for it, or through, or in English, we would say a contract. And this is derived from the verse we have here in Jeremiah. Now recall that Jeremiah was the prophet that predicted the destruction of the first temple in 586 BCE. And if you've read your book, while Jerusalem was under siege by the Babylonians, He was famous for purchasing land in Israel as an example of hope for the community. So he has this saying, Sadot Bakesef Yiknu, fields with money you shall be purchased. That's literally the translation of the Hebrew, but we buy land with money. V'chatov ba'sefer, and we write it in a sefer, in a book, in a document. V'chatom, and we seal it. And that's what you did in ancient times. You wrote out a deed and you signed it. Now, does anyone here know what you wrote the deed on?
Was it papyrus?
Parchment.
Okay.
Parchment.
So paper has not been invented. Papyrus didn't exist in Israel, only in Egypt.
Parchment.
And parchment was very, very, very expensive. So
clay tablets.
Pardon me?
Use clay tablets.
Yeah,
clay close. Tablets. You actually used broken pottery. And they were shards, or the technical term in the business is ostraca. And they find this all over the place. And this is, you'd write the document on a broken piece of ceramic, or broken piece of property, pottery. And they dig these things up all the time and they have them. So that's the mechanics of contracts in those days. Now, here's a question that is disputed. So when you signed the contract, did you own the property, or only when you paid the money for the contract? And I don't have the answer to that, but that is a dispute in the Talmud. And we won't discuss it. But it's something to think about, especially in terms of what we'll see tonight. So with everything now as a prelude, here we go into tonight's text. No, I'm sorry. We don't go into tonight's text. We start with one more audiovisual aid. And this is what we're going to talk about. So
you have wonderful audiovisual aids too, by the way. Thank you.
I'm glad you appreciate that. I spend a lot of time on them because they're the most fun. So if you have land, you have to pay to someone. You can sell the land to another party. But when you owe money based on that land, you now have what is called a lien. And a lien, I looked up the definition, is a right to keep possession of property belonging to another person until a debt owed by that person is discharged. So you own this $100 field, but you owe someone $25 from the field, which you can't make until you sell the field. So effectively, there's a lien on the property. And here is the start of tonight's discussion. You can sell the land with the lien to somebody else. And this is a legal transaction in the Talmud. Okay? And that means the debt is now transferred to the new owner. And forget about the $125, it's just numbers there, because presumably the new owner would pay less money for the land than the original owner because of the lien, because that property is no longer worth $100, it's worth $75 effectively. Now, you see at the bottom, Reuven and Shimon. So all of us are an age when we took math classes. And if you remember from math class, you had these kind of problems where it would say, A can dig a ditch in 3 hours and B can dig the ditch in 2 hours. Along comes C, how long will it take them to dig the same ditch in 5 hours, right? And you have these math classes with these people, A, B, and C. And because I'm kind of a nerd, there's even funny short stories where people tried to write like the private life of A, you know, he lives in a house with a dog, and B is a skinny guy who does this and that. At any rate, you know, the Talmud invents everything first. So when the Talmud wants to give these examples, they don't have A, B, and C. They have Reuven and Shimon. And when you need a third person, it's Levi. And you'll see that tonight. And it's literally in the Talmud. So if you want to have Talmudic street cred when you go into a yeshiva, you just start off with, well, I owe Reuven $5. And Shimon comes along and says this, and everyone will understand you. Okay, now we go to start off tonight. And we have a baraita. Our rabbis taught Tanu Rabbanan. So once again, whenever you see the word Tanu, Tanya, Ditnan, it means taught, and it means we have a baraita. So here's the baraita. And this is only part one of the baraita. Machar le'echad, if you sell to one person, o l'shlosha b'nei adam ka'echad, or to three people as one, or at one time, we'll get back to that. Kulan nichnasu tachad haba'alim, all enter into the position of the owner. All right. Here's the Talmud's assumption, which you wouldn't get out of this baraita. So the working assumption is a person owes money, whether it's to fix a damage case or repay a loan or pay a woman's marriage contract. And this person owns all three kinds of land, superior, medium, inferior. And now he sells his land. If he sold all of his land to one person or to three people, then all the buyers replace the land's prior owner with regard to repayment of debts. At the time when each debt is created, each creditor gains a lien, as I said before, on the plots of the debtor's land from which they have a right to collect. And the lien remains in effect even when the land is sold, even after the sale, and the creditors, and now here, these are people who are owed money, can collect. And we still keep up the thing of damages are collected from superior land, loans are collected from in medium land, and marriage contract from inferior land. All right. So we'll come back to, this is only the first half of Baraita. We'll come back, but time for another audiovisual display. So again, we have a person who has all three kinds of land. And the Baraita is saying he can sell all the land to one person or to three people. And three obviously is kind of a euphemism for many. Okay, second half of the Baraita. Zeh achar zeh, one after another, all collect from the last. If he does not have, meaning the last person, collect from the one before. If the second to last does not have, we collect from the one before him. So if he sold his property one plot at a time, the plaintiffs, the people who are owed money, first collect from the last one to purchase, and then work back in time until debts are repaid. Why? Because, I don't know if I'm giving this ahead. Okay, no, I'm gonna leave it that way. And why is this? So here, where do we get this from in effect? So the Sea of Talmud, we have a tractate Gittin, which is the word for get in Aramaic, which is the bill of divorce. It happens to be located there. A lot of this contract stuff is in this tractate. And this is again from the Talmud. And here's the explanation. So payment of debt is not collected from encumbered property, meaning property that has a lien on it, that has been sold to a third party, when the debtor still has, the person who owes the money still has unencumbered property, even if it's even if that property is inferior quality land. All right, so in more simple English is, you have properties that have liens on them, you have properties that don't, you sell off the properties that have liens, you normally would collect the debt from them, but as long as the original guy still has property, you go to him to collect your debt. All right, now we're going to have another audio visual. So in keeping with the spirit, we have Reuven. And Reuven owes money to Fred. That's my additional Talmudic name. And Reuven owns all three types of land. And we have liens on the land. So along comes, Shimon. Along comes Shimon. He buys the superior quality land. And then comes Levi, and he buys the medium quality land. Well, I went back too far. So what this is saying is Reuven still has that property and it still has the lien on it. So the people who are owed money collect from Reuven's inferior land. That's what the Braita is saying to us. Okay.
But Steve, realistically, in modern times, for example, you wouldn't sell the house, the property with the lien. You would satisfy the lien before
the proceeds.
Before the sale. I mean, anyone who's bought a house, that's usually what's done.
So
that is a title search.
It
has to be satisfied.
So Lynn will attest, I asked my brother-in-law, the medical salesman, because I needed someone with more financial knowledge. What happens today when you buy, a lien is a mortgage, by the way. Although in modern times, it may be different, but—
Well, a mortgage is a kind of lien, but there's other kinds of liens. There are tons of different types of liens.
I was afraid to say this in front of lawyers.
Right. When the title search is done, all those liens are satisfied before the property changes hands.
I am told that you can do this. Lawrence, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it is rare but still possible to sell the land, to sell the property with the mortgage.
Oh, you can, but I'm just saying it's not usually done. But if you want to take the land with the lien, you can, but it's just not.
Yeah. And Steve, you said initially that if the land was worth $100, if there was a $25 lien, you would sell the property for $75. And then you would have the $25 to pay. But if in other words, you sell the property for $25 less than it was worth with the assumption that the buyer would now assume the lien.
I said that because it made sense to me, but I don't know if that's true.
That's not really how it's done, but I wondered why you did that.
Well, because I just thought of the mechanics of I have property with a lien on it and I'm selling it to someone else. According to the Talmud, I don't know what he pays for it. I'll just put it that way.
Okay. Because if indeed I say, okay, you take over the lien and I'll knock $25 off the price and then I owe the money anyhow, I've lost the $25 on the sale and now I still have the debt of the $25.
No, it's the other way around, right? You pay $75 for $100 land.
No. I sold my land. I sold it only for $75 because I had a $25 lien on it.
Right.
So I expect the buyer to pay the lien, but you're saying that if I have other property, the debtor can still come to me for the $25, even though I've built that into the sale price.
Well, that's why I shouldn't have speculated on the sale price.
Oh, okay.
But that's really what we're going to be talking about tonight. And what happens here, just to finish this illustration, so the debtors come and they all collect from the inferior land. And if they can't raise enough money, the principle we just saw in the second part of the Baraita says, we then go to the last buyer, which would be Levi. And he now has to pay all the debts. And if he can't cover the debts, then we go to Shimon finally, only because of this order of purchase. That's the principle that was being illustrated here. All right, now, one of the other big goals of doing this is critical thinking. So this is the Baraita that that we start with tonight, that our sugya starts with. And what the Talmud always likes to do is go back and interrogate the Baraita, asking, is this really so? Is this what you mean? What about this case? So I'm going to now throw this open to you, and I put it back up. There are at least two problems I can see with this Baraita. So I want everyone to study this and see what question you might ask on this. I'm seeing furrowed brows.
Well, how do you determine the quality of the land? How are they supposed to determine what is best land and what is medium or inferior?
So that we covered in another case, which the court comes out and does that.
Oh, okay.
But since you can't see this, Arlene, what it says is sell to one or to three people at one time, all enter into the position of the owner.
The way I'm interpreting this is all of them assume a lien.
You're selling to three people. It's got to be three separate events, and they all can't be at the same time.
Ah, excellent. That's one of the big questions. How do you sell property to three people at the same time?
Well, that's easy.
with your pottery shard.
They made a movie called The Producers about that.
Yes. I have 10 acres of land. Okay. I sell Steve 2 acres. I sell Larry 5 acres. I sell Lawrence, or I sell Michelle the other 2 acres or 3 acres.
But how do you sell them at the same time?
All in the same room. So you're taking this, you're taking this, and you're taking that. Give me money.
Right.
You have a closing. You get together in the attorney's office. And the deeds are exchanged and the money is exchanged. It's the closing.
Okay. What if I sign the contract and then the other two buyers leave the room? Right?
Well, I bought my piece, but they haven't bought theirs. The deal is no good.
Yeah.
Well, alternatively, you have three people who have a contract among themselves, so they could be buying theirs.
A partnership.
Right, a partnership.
It also seems to me pretty tough on the third guy to have to take on the whole debt just because for whatever reasons he was low person on the totem pole and he got to, you know, complete the purchase the last.
Well, but in the world of free markets, theoretically then he would pay very little because he's taking the most risk. But that's not in this question at any rate. So David got one of those. Let's go look now. So I've restated this in Computeris because look at the parentheses, right? Sell to one or three people as a group at one time, or sell to one, and then the one time only goes to the three people. So the question here is, if you take the first reading, how do you sell to one person at one time? I mean, at the same time. That's the question. And if you go to the bottom one, this is what David said. How do you sell to three people simultaneously?
Well, if they've got a partnership agreement among them.
No, then they're really one buyer. So they don't count. We're each person, Shimon, Reuven, and Levi, all have their own plot.
It's called tenants in common. They like just like.
No, but they're not in common. They're three separate individuals.
Oh, three separate.
How do we know that?
Because that's what the Gemara is asking.
How do we know that?
It doesn't say three people in a limited partnership, Michelle.
We don't know that.
We do know that because that's the question.
There's no way it can be the same exact piece of property because three people can't, unless they are partners, and then they are, as you say, one person. Three people cannot own the same thing at the same time.
No, it's so three different plots.
No, but they would own a portion of it. Each
all
one
All right, so
owns
they each
a
own
portion.
A different portion, so each portion
it's,
stands
it's subdivided.
Alone, as it were. So the lien kept on trickling down and trickling down until it was in the least, the last portion, and therefore, I guess, yes, the last person really did buy the lien along with the property, because the first one shoved it into the second shoved it into the third, and the third had no place to, pay it off, put it off onto.
No, you guys are all making the wrong assumptions here, right? Reuven owns three pieces of land, and he sells one piece to Shimon, one piece to Levi, and one piece to Michelle. That's what the scenario is here. There's no partnership. So
how does he
That's what builders do. They buy a huge tract of land, and let's say they want to put up 10 houses on that land. So they build a house, and they sell it to the first buyer, and simultaneously they may be building two or three more houses. They sell them to the various buyers. Then when the builder buys the property, he usually doesn't have the money outright, so he has a mortgage. Now, the mortgage is for a property that is intended for 10 houses. As he sells each house...
But Arlene, this is not our scenario. You're making it way more complicated than we are at this point. We have one person who owns three pieces of land, and he is selling each one of the pieces of land.
So that question is,
how can he sell them simultaneously, each one their own plot?
Why can't he have three pieces?
Well, why not? I don't see what the problem is. Each one will pay him the amount that they have agreed to pay.
But here's the problem.
And they'll own that portion.
What's bothering me is where Talmud said that the debtor can collect. Forget about the original debtor, okay? He sold off the land went with a lien. So he kept on rolling the lien out of the piece that he sold so he could get the maximum price for it. No.
Lynn, you're making an assumption. That's also not true. Each piece of property has a lien on it because he's got to pay off. He's got to pay off all three types of parties.
Oh, but didn't you tell us that he had one lien and then that he only had one lien on his one piece of property?
No. Reuven owns three pieces of property.
Oh, and he each had a lien on him.
From the superior land, he has a lien because his cow ate his neighbor's field. From the medium property, he has a lien because he borrowed money. And from the inferior land, he has a lien because he's divorcing his wife.
So why can't he have three pieces of pottery and sell them all three at the same time?
Well, think about it physically.
Well, I don't understand what the problem is.
I mean, maybe he's retiring and he doesn't want to farm anymore, so he sells off his land.
Because, go ahead.
I'm less worried about how he could do it simultaneously and more worried about the fact that the recourse of the debtor is in the first place to him, but then the other people.
But Lynn, you're
the last one to do the buying has to pay all of the liens.
No.
Well, it depends, but no, not in this case. That's not the question.
What problem are we dealing with?
The problem is this: if three people buy the land, then as soon as one person buys, and the Talmud says they all become the owner. So physically, when he sells land to person one, that's not true anymore. There's some debt on his side, there's some debt on their side. And if you froze right at that point, it would be a different situation. They wouldn't all three become owners of the debt.
But you said that there was a lien on each of them. So I still don't understand why there's a problem with him selling pieces.
Basically physics. How can they each acquire land? Because they're signing a contract.
Right.
So when one signs the contract, they get the land. The other two are still not bought yet.
So, I don't understand. There's three separate pieces of land and three separate buyers. So he needs three pieces of pottery. I don't see what the problem is.
Okay.
Is it just that he can't be signing his name, simultaneously on three places?
No, they will. Okay. I'm going to give you the Talmud's answer to this. So Talmud first starts off with sell to one. What are the circumstances? Now it repeats Machran le'echad. It's repeating the opening lines of the Baraita. That's, we've seen this a lot now. What are the circumstances? And this is written very tersely, right? So if it said sell to one, then the Baraita is superfluous. It's obvious if you sell the land, all three pieces of land to one person, that person now becomes the new owner, and you don't need to state that. It's redundant. That's the problem the Talmud has with that language. This is the case of parentheses one. Now, when you have three, where it is possible to say one came before the other, you said all enter into the position of owner. So the suggestion here, no, not suggestion. I'll go back a second. So we're saying if you said it one time, the assumption is being made, the buyer bought all three pieces of land at one time. But this is rejected. Because when three people buy the land on the same day, it is possible they bought it at different times on that day. How then can we say that they are all in place of the seller? Therefore, when one person buys the property, we don't have to teach he's in place of the seller. Rashi comes along to resolve this. And he says the meaning of the phrase at one time should really be translated as with one contract, right? So that changes the dynamic here. You write the contract, person one signs it. 2 hours later, person two signs it. 1 hour later, person three signs it. Then at nightfall, the contract takes effect. And all the property is then transferred, and that's how we do it. That's the Talmud's answer. Now, what about the other case? So if that's true, why do we need the Talmud to say sell to one? That's the next question it asks in that group. And the answer is, it's the case of one person buying the land at three different times. That's why we have that phrase at one time. Okay, we'll move along. This also raises a difficulty. All right, what's the problem here? What is different about three that each one can say two, and that's literally how it's translated. It's not my typo. I left you place to collect from. So when you sell to three people, and Lynn, this is going to address what you're thinking. Each one can say, I left you a place to collect from the seller. That is, when I bought my property, seller, you still had other property left. So you can collect that other from the other land before you take my property. That's the Talmud's answer to that. Now we have the second sentence, which seems to be the same as the first sentence, but it's really a different case. And here's the case of the different types of land. So one buyer can say, I first bought the superior and the medium land, leaving you to collect from the inferior land. But this is also a problem. Why does the Baraita rule that in this case, each creditor collects from the land that was originally leaned to him? Because that's what it was saying. So once again, how does the Talmud resolve problems with Baraita? It says, oh, you're not understanding the specifics. So really, we're only talking about a case where the superior land was purchased last. So the purchaser is happy to let the plaintiffs collect from the property he previously purchased because it is of lower quality. That way they don't all collect from the best land.
Not his anymore. He sold it.
Oh, the other guy.
Accordingly, the buyer is satisfied with allowing each creditor to collect from the land that was previously leaned to him rather than to collect from the superior land. And we have this agreement with Ralph Sheshet. I don't know why that's in there, but he's a big guy, so we say that. Once again, the Talmud, the Gemara is not satisfied with this explanation, right? Theoretically, well, if so, let all of them come and collect from the superior land. Theoretically, the plaintiffs can all collect from the last property to be sold, which is the superior land. But we know everyone is supposed to collect according to the quality of the land they deserve. And if you do what's being said here, where the owner again is selling off, then everyone will collect from superior land, and that's not fair. It's not fair to the owner. How do we get around that? So he, the owner, tells them, if you are silent and take according to the law, in other words, the piece you deserve, then take it. But if you don't, I will return the deed of the inferior land to the owner. In other words, I'll renege on a sale and you will all take from inferior land. So he's got that power, that selling power. Okay.
Oh.
We now, just so I always like to note, we are now moved to the other side of DAF 8. We are on DAF 8B. And now we have that principle. But here's a problem. We know the damaged party collects from superior land. So what are we saying here? If the buyer can make this threat, why can't he say the same thing to a person who's collecting for damages? In other words, you can take the inferior land, but if not, I'll sell back the bad property, the damager from whom I bought it, and you'll be forced to take the bad quality land. So this threat would undermine the damaged party's ability to collect from the other buyers, the third parties. So the Talmud says, someone has some noise in the background, please. So rather, what are we dealing with here? And here we come, we're really talking about orphans. Like, where did that come from? We're talking about about a case where the debtor dies and leaves the land to orphans, because orphans are not responsible to pay debts of the estate. Rashi explains this. The debts of a deceased person are not collectible from his children's movable property or privately owned land, only from land inherited by them from the deceased. Accordingly, in this case, when the debtor died without leaving any land to his children, the obligation to pay the lien lies exclusively with the buyer. So in the case of orphans and the land comes down, they don't inherit the lien, and basically it doesn't come to them.
Okay, Steve?
Yes.
When they say orphans, are they saying, is that the same word that we think of orphan, a child without mother or father?
Correct.
Or is that the surviving children of a person who just passed away?
It's the same thing in this case.
Okay. So in other words, if a man passes away, his children inherit the land, they're right, not responsible for the father's debts.
There are, yes. Well, yes, that's true.
Okay.
Well, didn't it say responsible for land they inherited?
I take back that statement, which is, if the man had land, that he incurred a debt on, the creditors can recover that from the property, but not from the children's personal value.
Right.
So they don't inherit his debt in that way.
Only the debt on the land. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That makes sense.
So therefore he cannot say this. Therefore, one cannot say the ruling in the Baraita is based on the fact that the buyer can threaten to return the bill of sale, or in this case, to his orphans. In this case, even if he were to return the bill of sale, the creditors would not be able to collect from the land now in the orphans' possessions, as they receive it anew, not as an inheritance. Therefore, the creditors can still collect from the plots of lands that remain with the buyer.
If the children didn't get an inheritance, how do they have any land?
They might have owned land themselves, private land.
No, they don't go into their personal property. They only are responsible for what they have inherited.
Okay.
Well, like with us, I mean, if your father dies and owes money, they can't go after you to collect it, except for what you inherit from your father. From that, they can collect.
Okay, good. Rather, he can say to them, why did the rabbi say that cannot collect from encumbered properties in a place where there are unencumbered properties? We saw this 10 slides ago. This was the Gemara from Tractate Gittin. So it is due to an ordinance for my benefit. And I do not find this ordinance for me. Okay. So the Gemara now wants to give a different answer to why they don't, going back a step, to why they don't collect from the best land, since that was the last land purchased. The reason is the creditors cannot all collect from superior land is that the buyer tells them, we don't collect from encumbered land, in other words, land with a lien, while there is still unencumbered land. This is an enactment that helps the buyer. But the buyer can say, I don't want the enactment. The rabbi said that those collecting debts collect first from the available property, and then only if such property is not available, they collect from the encumbered property. The plaintiffs do not all collect from the last piece of property because the purchaser can deny making use of the rabbinic enactment. In this case, the enactment means they should collect from the best property because that was the best property to get a lien. But the purchaser does not have to take advantage of this. Rather, he can say, each of you collect from the property owed to you by law. Now we run into a philosophical argument. It's kind of a tangent. Do we have the right to pass on a rabbinic law, even if it's in our favor? And this is in accordance with Rava, who's another sage, a fourth generation Babylonian Amora. Rava says, anyone who says, I do not want an ordinance of the sages, such as this, Kigon Zeh, one listens to him. So Rava taught elsewhere that you don't have to accept a rabbinic decree, even if it's in your own financial benefit. So where's his proof of this? And we go right back to the previous text, Kigon Zeh. What does that mean? What are you talking about? So this is in accordance with Rav Huna, who is a second generation Babylonian Amora. What case can you cite? And the case he cites is, a woman is entitled to say to her husband, I don't want any maintenance and I don't want to work. What does this mean? So a married woman has a right to receive maintenance from her husband. And maintenance says necessities such as food, clothing, and housing.
It's actually in the ketubah.
It is in the ketubah. But in return, the husband has the rights to her earnings.
Oh.
Now, yeah. If she wants, she has the right to withdraw from this enactment and keep her own earnings. But then the husband no longer has to provide maintenance. And this is an example of a person who does not take advantage of a rabbinic enactment.
The husband has the right to do what?
I'm saying that again?
The husband has a right to do what?
The husband does not have any rights here. Oh. Well, the husband has the obligation to give his wife necessities. And in return, he's allowed to take her earnings. That's his right. I mean, that's his obligation. But if she foregoes that obligation and says, I'm keeping my earnings, he no longer has to pay her necessities.
Right. Well, the presumption is if she's working, she can support herself. I mean, when you talk about necessity, you're talking about alimony. And for a woman who doesn't work,
no, she's married. This is not this is not alimony. She's married.
Oh, I thought you meant in case of a divorce.
No.
All right.
No, which is a right to favor or a what? Last word I could catch.
I'm not sure what your question is. She can pass on the right to be maintained.
She can pass?
She can give up that right.
Okay.
She gets to keep her salary.
And then she keeps her own money.
I was about to say, but in exchange, she doesn't get any benefit from financial benefit from the husband.
That is right.
She has to be, I think the words we're looking for is financial independence.
Yes. Yes. The fancy word for this, by the way, is usufruct. That, like, the classic example is she owns an orchard. When she gets married, the husband gets to keep all the fruit and sell it and do whatever he wants with it. And that is the term for it. But if she wants to live high on her own fruit, she can do that.
Steve, does it matter if it's contractual as opposed to relying on the rabbinic law? In other words, if there's a rabbinic law that says this is, you know, the husband has to maintain and gets the benefit, and you can, and the wife can avoid that, say, I don't want that. But if it's in the contract, can she just ignore the ketubah?
The ketubah, she doesn't have a right. Yeah, she does have a right to be maintained, but she can forego that right. That is not in the ketubah, but it is understood as part of the law.
Got it. All right.
Okay. So how does that apply in what we're talking about? And this is the last slide. So it is obvious, pshita, as this Talmud likes to say, that if the buyer sold the medium and inferior land and kept the superior, they can come and collect out of the superior. We know that. That's what we've been talking about all night. For it is the last, and he no longer has the medium and inferior, such that he could say to them, collect from the medium and inferior, as I do not wish the rabbinic decree. So he has sold the land of intermediate and inferior quality. However, he cannot unilaterally waive the ordinance without the consent of the second buyer. And that's what this case is. I want to go back a step and explain this more clearly because it's a little more complicated than it seems. So this is a limitation on the buyer's ability to refuse the ordinance, the rabbinic ordinance. So it is obvious that if the buyer sold the land he purchased from the debtor, if he sold the intermediate and inferior land to a second buyer, this is what we're talking about now. So it's Reuven to Shimon to Levi. And retained in his possession superior land, which he had purchased last, this is Shimon now, then all the creditors may come and collect from the superior land. For if the intermediate land and the inferior land were in his possession, he could say to the creditors, collect from the intermediate and inferior land, as it is not satisfactory to me to avail myself of this ordinance of the sages. So he can get away with that. Now that he sold the land of intermediate and inferior quality, he cannot waive the ordinance without the consent of Levi, of the second buyer. Because the second buyer benefits from the ordinance because it compels the creditors to collect from Shimon, the first buyer, and therefore he will not agree to waive it. So in effect, the first buyer cannot waive the rabbinic enactment because it will negatively affect the second buyer. And that's where we stop. There is a bunch more of this, probably about another half the session worth, but I figured this is complicated stuff and everyone's mind is has had enough for tonight.
So you're going to keep us in suspense.
I will keep you in suspense, but hopefully there will be more audiovisual aids when we return.
So the next session is December 16th.
The next section is December 16th.
We'll be next week.
Short hiatus.
Will there be a big reveal on the 16th?
Only if the text brings me there.
Oh.
No. I still don't get what the underlying reason for all of this is. I'm finding it very difficult to find out why they made this whole thing, because I don't know what in practical real life it's supposed to take care of.
I have a feeling the whole thing means something different to you than to me. I mean, you understand the part about paying debts. Incurring debts and paying for them.
Stephen, and I think one of the challenges we have is we're trying to use today's financial philosophies right. on a text that's, you know, thousands of years old, and maybe we need to kind of look at it in a much more basic way. You know, when all they had was, you know, agriculture to trade with.
I don't think, okay, my personal philosophy is the science may have changed, the realities of life may have changed, but the principles of human nature do not change.
True.
So what we've been dealing with is being responsible, paying debts, damages that you owe, and complications in discharging that. Right? I mean, go all the way back to first principles. I own land. That's all property I have. I owe you money. I have to sell the land and pay you, right? That's a pretty bedrock kind of thing. And now we start building the tower of complications. Well, what if this? What if that? And I don't see where that has fallen down so far, where we could look at it as modern people and say, this is unfair or this is wrong.
Could we reprise this when we start the next session? Because I don't know about anybody else. I certainly have unanswered questions as to what we're supposed to take away from this.
Well, sure. I don't want to jump into this cold turkey either.
Yeah, so let's reprise it in 2 weeks when we meet again.
And I'm going to look back and do some research and see about the superior land question.
Okay.
So basically what's happening is there's a ruling on paying damages.
Right.
And now the rabbis are saying, well, what if this and what if that and what if the other thing and who gets what and where and what, looking at all the different possibilities. In modern parlance, the law says you have to operate your vehicle in a safe manner at all times. You're driving down the road, you get in an accident. Well, if you hit a piece of ice, your liability is different than if you were just driving down the road at 90 miles an hour and slammed into somebody. You know, and this is what the rabbis are doing. They're looking at the different possibilities. The world they lived in, the possibilities were different than the world we know. They didn't have courts and banks that said, oh, the mortgage will be this and the lien will be that, and you have to do it this way. They had to have their own methods of determining all this.
I agree with you completely. And I would add that the rabbis also are striving all the time to be fair.
Right.
Even if, in a sense, I hate to use this word, there's kind of a social justice aspect whereby they're bending the rule a little for a higher goal of, let's say, societal equality or fairness or something. And I think that, in effect, is, to me, is like the Jewish spin on these things.
Right. Yeah. And that's why they slice the onion so many different directions.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to think about it, but hopefully rather than just go on, we'll reprise this and think about this some more in the next session.
Very good.
Thanks.
Everyone,
okay, bye.
Have a good evening.
Thanks,
you
Steve.
Thank bye. You, Steve.
Bye-bye. Yes, David. I think you muted yourself, or did you not say something? All right.
Okay, I have a question for you.